So I turn myself to face me. I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Turn and face the strain.
Change.
Good morning, everyone. It is Friday, January 12th, 2018, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Packers Podcast. My name is Michael Cohen, and I'm here, as always, with fellow beat reporter Tom Silverstein. Tom, it's been a little bit of a while for us since we've had one of these podcasts. Have you enjoyed our little respite here?
Well, I sort of feel like I've been underground, you know, just kind of tethered to my phone for this since the season ended. It's just been absolutely crazy. I feel like I'm just now coming up for air. You know, every day there's something going on and new things to find out and new people getting fired and new people getting hired. And it's just been a circus.
It definitely has been a circus, and it all really started the morning after the regular season ended with that disappointing and sort of embarrassing lost to the Detroit Lions. And I think the first thing that everybody sort of caught wind of was that maybe around midday on the day after the season, so that would have been New Year's Day, Dom Capers, defensive coordinator, was relieved of his duties. And then shortly after that, we found out that his two of his assistants, Mike Turgovac, the defensive line coach, and Scott McCurley, the inside linebackers coach, had been let go as well. I wasn't surprised at all. I know we've talked about this a lot. I assume that you're sort of in the same boat, that this wasn't anything that caught you off guard with Capers.
No. You know, I'd sort of called for it in my column, and I really think that this was decided well before the Lions game, that, you know, McCarthy knew, even if they made the playoffs, I think that decision might have been made anyways. Sort of, you know, similar to what Carolina's done, you know, I just think at some point a change has to be made, and, you know, maybe in retrospect it should have been made sooner, but McCarthy had to do something.
And so he decides to part ways with Capers, who had been there for, what, 9 seasons, I believe it was. And then the search begins for the defensive coordinator and his replacements almost immediately. But before any of that really gets going, within a couple of hours later on New Year's Day, we catch wind of the big bombshell, which is that general manager Ted Thompson, after 13 years in that role, will be transitioning to a new role that ended up being senior advisor to football operations. Now, I certainly thought the end was getting near for Ted Thompson in terms of, you know, the overall spectrum of his career, but I have to say this one definitely caught me by surprise. I did not think, A, that this would be his final season, and B, I didn't think that if it was his final season, it would happen so swiftly after week 17. What was your impression of just, you know, the timing of all of this and just the decision in general that Thompson's no longer GM?
Yeah, well, one thing I can tell you is that it didn't happen on January 1st. The decision wasn't made January 1st. This is something that they had been talking about throughout the season. I think Ted's energy level was waning. I think there was some concern from the board of directors about that. I think it was just time. Murphy recognized that it was time for a change, and they had to figure out a transition plan. And I think they did that in mid-season. At some point, whenever they extended Mike McCarthy's contract a year, they decided, let's do that. Then, you know, we'll have a GM search, and you'll step aside. And I think Ted was okay with that, I think. You know, we don't know for sure because Ted will never speak his mind. But I was also surprised that it happened that quickly. But, you know, it's not a bad idea to keep him around for a year. He's really not in a decision-making mode. And I think he's pretty much going to be looking at tape and giving Brian Gutekunst some, you know, advice on guys that he looks at.
Yeah, I really agree with you. And I think that my guess is that over the course of the 13 years, when Ted first started, you know, of course, from the very beginning, he loves scouting above anything else. And he loves watching players and going out and monitoring guys and watching college practices and writing reports. And he loves all of that stuff. And so I sort of get the sense, you know, from having learned a little bit about Ted and having spent some time around people that know him, I kind of just got the sense that all the other responsibilities that come with being a GM in terms of the, you know, the administrative types of things, all the other responsibilities that are on his plate, you know, he was willing to tolerate those when A1 bottom line scouting was what he loved more than anything. And my guess is that as these 13 years went along, and you mentioned his energy waning, I don't think there's any doubt about that. My guess is that the passion that he had left as it started to dwindle a little bit was still for scouting, and that it was the other things around the scouting and the player evaluation that started to weigh on him a little bit more, and that finally it got to a position where, you know, he and Murphy and the board also just sort of realized that the best way to utilize him moving forward is exactly what you said. Put him in a room, have him watch tape, send him on the road, have him watch players, and just have him purely be an evaluator. Because as you've written in your column, people can rip Ted all they want, but he is very clearly a keen evaluator of talent. And I still think he can be. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I do. I don't think he's lost that ability. I think maybe the communication skills, the you know, his, like you said, the energy level might be down, but I don't think his ability to look at a player and say, this guy's going to be a good player, this guy isn't. You know, it's a really, and we won't know this for a couple of years, but, you know, these past two drafts might turn out to be pretty darn good for him. You know, there's certainly, it's certainly looking like there's some players out of that that, you know, might be here for a while. And, you know, I don't think he's made any really egregious mistakes of late. So we'll have to see. You know, it all kind of depend on how it plays out. But I think he does still possess that evaluation talent.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned the last two drafts, because I think if you were to go back 3 years and you look at 2015, and you could say 2015, he might have missed a lot. I mean, you talk about nobody knows what Demarius Randle is going to be, because he's played well at times, and at other times he's looked horrendous. And then Quentin Rollins in the second round, he was pretty much on the fringe of playing time to begin with, and now he suffers an injury with the torn Achilles that, you know, you've seen over the years is extremely difficult to come back from, especially when you're not that fast to begin with. So I agree with you. The 2016 and 2017 drafts seem to be very solid rebounds from what might have been, you know, a pretty poor hall of players in 2015. So I guess the next thing I'm wondering is, we finally get this news that Ted is going to transition to a new role. Obviously, there's going to be a GM search. From the moment you heard the news, how did you sort of handicap the race in terms of the three guys that they have? And then we'll just call option four anybody external. So of those four options, how did you handicap it at the very beginning?
Well, you know, so of course, I'm basing my opinion on what I'm hearing from people around the organization, people outside the organization with ties to the Packers. I'm trying to find out from as many people as I can who the leading candidates are. And, you know, there's a misconception that, I'll start out by saying the overwhelming opinion was Russ Ball. I mean, it was pretty close to a slam dunk as far as everyone was, at least that was the perception. And, you know, I wrote that because the perception was, even among the candidates, that Russ Ball was going to get the job. Now, that wasn't a prediction, but it was what the climate was at that time. And I do believe the climate changed during the course of that search. I think it shifted. But I do believe that Russ Ball, you go into every search, you know, any, you make a move like that, you better have at least a decent idea who you want to replace a person like Ted. You just can't go into that blind and say, well, let's see who knocks my socks off. You know, it just doesn't happen that way. And so I believe that Russ was the leader coming out of the gate.
I completely agree with you. You know, dating back to, you know, the story that I wrote on Ted a couple summers ago, where I talked to a lot of people around him. And then this past summer, I wrote those two stories on Russ Ball. And it became pretty clear to me that despite, you know, the presence of Elliot Wolf, despite the presence of Brian Gutekunst and Alonzo Highsmith, three scouts that Ted had really, you know, taken under his wing and really developed over the last 10 or 12 or 15 years, I thought it was pretty clear that they were trying to groom Russ Ball to move into this role. Now, I don't know if that's because they just felt that, you know, with Russ being a little bit older and with having some more, what's the best way to say this? A little bit more financial hesitancy that sort of mirrors the way Ted has run the team. I don't know if that appealed to them, that he was going to be the option. I think you wrote it in your column and you phrased it pretty well, that Russ Ball would be the closest option to Ted that they could find. I don't know if that was something that appealed to them. But I agree with you. I don't think that there was any doubt that Russ Ball was the perceived leader in the clubhouse going into this. And I also wonder if some of the comments that we heard from Mike McCarthy really sort of jolted, you know, team president Mark Murphy a little bit. And the comment in particular that I'm talking about is the one that basically, you know, him saying that the GM needs to fit with him, that the GM needs to give him better players, all those things. And again, you wrote a column about that as well. So knowing McCarthy, knowing the power structure as you do, having covered the team for so long, is it reasonable to assume that the forcefulness that McCarthy displayed in that press conference could have influenced Mark Murphy in a way that caused him to change his opinion a little bit?
Absolutely. I think he faced a dilemma there. Now, you know, McCarthy has 2 years left on his contract, and he's sitting there. He's worked with a guy who he hired him and who has his interest. So all of a sudden, that's going to change, and it's going to be someone who's younger than him. It's going to be either a guy with no personnel. Well, it wouldn't be younger if it were Russ Ball, but it was going to be someone who, if Russ Ball, it would be someone who wasn't involved in personnel and wouldn't be aggressive, or is going to be someone younger with less experience. And so McCarthy, no question, probably through the advice of his agent, you know, came out swinging in his season-ending press conference and made it clear that the fit has to be both ways. And I found it a little bit shocking that he was involved in the interview process, since really the head coach should be completely separate from the GM. The GM is a management position, and I know the head coaches too, but I would never have my head coach. To me, that's like having Aaron Rodgers in meetings for free agency. You know, it's like you don't bring Aaron Rodgers in to tell you what to do with your team. You don't bring your head coach in to tell you who to hire. So to me, that was really weird. And then but I think he managed to get Mark Murphy's ear. I don't think he had any kind of a card he could play about quitting or leaving. You know, if I'm Murphy, and if he probably figured out that Murphy was not the kind of guy who would tell him, you know, go ahead and quit. I don't care. You got 2 years in your contract. You can sit. And after, you know, however long and you decide you want to come back, you're still property of us. You know, really, that's what he could say. And, you know, but McCarthy probably figured Murphy wasn't that way. And so he might have given them some threats or, you know, at least I'm out of here, you know, or I'd like to negotiate my way out of here. Or I don't know. But whatever the case was, he got himself involved.
So there's two sort of ways that I thought about this. And I completely agree with you that there's no doubt that McCarthy's demeanor in that press conference certainly had some sway on Mark Murphy. But as the days passed, I was trying to think about why McCarthy would do that from two different points of view. And I still think that the reason he did it is the one you just explained. But for the sake of throwing out an alternate opinion, I was just kind of wondering. So, you know, having talked to a number of people that know Ted very, very well over the years, I had it on very good authority that Mike McCarthy would be allowed to coach the Packers for as long as Ted was GM. So it doesn't matter what would have happened, barring, you know, an 0-16 catastrophe. Ted was never going to fire Mike McCarthy. And he wasn't going to be here for that many years anyway, so that's not a very bold statement. But what I'm getting at is that if McCarthy had come out and lobbied for Russ Ball, you could make the argument that that might have increased his job security, because Russ Ball maybe would have been more aligned with Ted and less likely to fire McCarthy, whereas by seeking out by putting so much more emphasis on players and winning now, you could argue that he opened himself up to exactly what you've pointed out in some of your stories, and also, you know, what I've talked about on the radio too, and that he's essentially created a 2018 season in which he has to win, and he has to win big. And so what's sort of your take on that? Because if he had sort of pushed for the old guard and Russ Ball, he might have had better job security. But by pushing for Gutekunst, he may get better talent, and yet it also might create a more pressurized situation for him.
Yeah. I mean, I think he has set up a situation where he does need to win. If he has a losing season this year, then the decision isn't in Murphy's hands. And my guess is if he's willing to push Ted out, then he's willing to push McCarthy out. So next, but on the other hand, McCarthy gets a guy in Gutekunst who favors free agency and will get him players and will continue to try to get him players as the season goes on. This is going to be different than what Ted does. So it's kind of a calculated risk that McCarthy's taking. Okay, well, you know, at least I'm going to get players, and I'm confident in my ability that if I get players, we're going to win. That's how McCarthy looks at it. If for some reason, you know, Rodgers gets hurt and Hundley's a quarterback again and they stink again, then it's on him. If his defensive coordinator fails, whatever, it's completely on him. And then I think we'll see a change. Murphy will be forced to, by the public will absolutely demand it. And so on the one hand, he's helped himself. On the other, he's put himself in a tough spot there.
And honestly, I don't even necessarily think it's a matter of a losing season versus winning season. I think he could make the playoffs and still get fired, because I think he's put it in a situation where they need to not only make the playoffs, but they need to make a significant run. And that doesn't necessarily mean going 10-6 and getting a wild card and getting hot because Rodgers is playing well down the stretch. I think they need to play well all season. And to me, again, I think he got the guy he wanted in Gutekunst, the guy that you mentioned will reward him with good players. And I think it's kind of like a do or die season for him. But I guess at the end of the day, despite the fact that I really think that Russ Ball was the guy that was going to get the job, I do think that Murphy got it right by selecting Brian Gutekunst. Would you agree that even though we both believe Russ Ball was the favorite, that ultimately they made the correct choice in hiring a personnel guy?
I do. I do think that was the correct choice. And, you know, I'm a little bit, and I'm sort of copying someone who I trust's opinion on this. But, you know, if Gutekunst opened Murphy's eyes with his interview and Jed Hughes, the headhunter, sort of convinced him that Gutekunst was a really hot property in the GM race, why didn't he know that? I mean, shouldn't he?
It's a great question.
Isn't his job to know that? And maybe that's why he wants these guys to report to him, that he was blown away that he didn't know anything about Brian Gutekunst. Regardless, at least he made the right choice, I think. You know, Elliot Wolf was a good choice too, but there's a lot of concern about the legacy and the pressure he would be under to follow in his dad's footsteps. The age is a factor too, 35 years old, but I do think the legacy thing is something that people worry about, that there would be just untold pressure on him to do what his dad did. And I think to some degree he does need to fly on his own a little bit, and then maybe he comes back to Green Bay. But Gutekunst, I think, was positioned better right now to do this job. And from all, you know, indications, all, you know, reports I've heard, he interviews really well. He's smart. He's level-headed. And he came up through the system. You know, he didn't take any shortcuts. So in the end, I do think it is the right choice. That'll be determined. But, you know, maybe he should have been the choice in the beginning. And that to me is probably a question that will kind of, I don't want to say haunt, but it will always be in my mind as why that wasn't the case.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the Murphy stuff, and that's kind of something I wanted to touch on a little bit. Basically, I've seen tons and tons and tons of fan reaction to Murphy's idea that there were these silos and this poor communication from department to department. And everything that I've seen from fans, or the majority, is blaming that 101,000,000% on Ted Thompson. And trust me, I understand why that would be the gut reaction. And there's no doubt that Ted is at fault for some of that. But Murphy is at fault for some of that too. I mean, he is the guy that runs this team. And if he is not aware of what's going on underneath him, or if he's not in tune enough to be able to recognize some of the problems, then that's on him as well. And Murphy is a guy that I don't know very well. I've never sat down and talked to him one-on-one. But I do find it interesting that seemingly every time he speaks to the media in a press conference setting, which is not very often, I'd say it's about a handful of times a year at most. He always, always, always references public opinion. And I know that his job requires him to be out there in the community a little bit more, but it's amazing to me that in a building where Mike McCarthy, the players, the coaches, the GM, the assistant GMs that we speak to at the draft, all these guys, they always say that public opinion doesn't mean anything to them and it's only what matters inside the building. Murphy seems like the one guy that is very conscious and potentially reactive to a lot of this public opinion. And I wonder if the years over the last couple seasons and the months of people really questioning why he's not involved more, whether he took that personally and felt that he needed to make some sort of big display to show that he is really in charge.
Could have been. That's a very good point. I think he's taking on just an enormous task to manage, this situation. This isn't, well, I don't want to compare it to Jerry Jones. Maybe it is like Jerry Jones. Here's a guy who's not steeped in football. I mean, yes, he knows football, but he's not really a general manager. And all of a sudden, he's going to be making decisions that affect the entire organization instead of, necessarily letting his own guys do it. I don't know. I think you're right that Murphy was gaining this reputation as a guy who just built sledding hills, and hunting stores and, hotels. That's all he was interested in, and that things were getting away from him. To get to the point that you were saying about Thompson receiving a lot of the blame, I was really surprised that he was willing to go that far. And I thought, in that moment, it probably should have been, a tribute to Ted Thompson. He's done a great job, I just want to do this a different way. Instead, he kind of made it, I thought he kind of dumped on Thompson a little bit.
I agree.
And in the long run, Thompson's legacy will overcome that, winning a Super Bowl and being competitive and all those playoff games or seasons in a row will be overshadow the other stuff. But, it still was kind of surprising to me that he didn't massage that a little bit better.
Now, in terms of the power structure in general, the new format is that Mike McCarthy, Brian Gutekunst, and Russ Ball will all deport, excuse me, will all report directly to Mark Murphy. So Brian Gutekunst no longer has direct authority to hire and fire a coach, and Russ Ball does not report to his what everyone would seem to be his what everyone excuse me what everyone would presume to be his direct boss in Brian Gutekunst. Same with Mike McCarthy. His people what people might think would be his direct boss, Brian Gutekunst, he's not going there either. So there was obviously a column by our colleague Pete Doherty in which he expressed what he felt were negative feelings about the power structure, and that it could potentially create some issues where guys are going around each other to complain to Murphy or vent to Murphy if things don't go very well. What was your reaction to the power structure, and how do you think it will influence, the next year or two, assuming all three of these guys are still in place over that time?
Well, I don't like this structure. I'm gonna go on record that I think it's a big mistake. I do think for a year or two it could work. I think, the newness of it, the let's turn this thing around, the camaraderie, you know. And then after you get, through a couple of years, then some of the petty stuff starts coming out. And that's just human nature. That just happens when you have people with lots of confidence, strong opinions, their jobs are on the line. You're going to have that kind of conflict. I mean, it's not White House conflict, but it's enough that you're going to have people once in a while going, this is crazy. I got to go to Mark Murphy and tell him my point. Imagine if Gutekunst, let's say this year, finds a free agent that he just loves, and he wants to spend. He's willing to push the cap to the extreme. And Russ Ball is sitting there going, "Oh, no way. We can't do that." And he's gone on and on and told Gutekunst, "This is a bad idea. We can't do this. Don't do it." And Gutekunst says, "I don't care. I'm doing it." The next thing you know, Russ Ball's in Mark Murphy's office saying, "We can't do this. This is going to kill us financially." So, what happens then? Then Murphy overrules his GM, and this whole thing could happen with McCarthy too. "I need this player. I gotta have this player." And Gutekunst goes, "No, I don't believe in him." And then McCarthy goes to Murphy. So there's all kinds of scenarios. I don't like it. I think the door, everything led to Ted Thompson's door, ultimately, and there was no going around his front door to Murphy. And so that's not a bad thing. Murphy needs to be conscious of all these things that are going on, but he doesn't need to be an arbiter. And I sort of feel like that's what's going to happen.
What do you make of the fallout of the decision to hire Brian Gutekunst? Obviously, even before Gutekunst was selected, we saw Alonzo Highsmith depart for Cleveland to reunite with John Dorsey. And then since he hired Gutekunst, it did not take long for everyone to pretty much understand that Elliot Wolf was going to go out of town. It was just a matter of where. And he could have certainly stayed in Green Bay if he wanted to, as what Gutekunst described as a right-hand man. He could have gone to Oakland, reportedly, for a job with Reggie McKenzie. And then, of course, he accepted a job in Cleveland to be the number two for Dorsey. So what do you think are the potential ramifications of losing those guys? And is this sort of what you expected, that there were going to be some big shakeups regardless of who was chosen as GM?
Yeah, I mean, if it was Ball, they could have lost Gutekunst and Wolf. If it was Gutekunst, they were going to lose Wolf. If it was Wolf, they might have lost Gutekunst. So, I think, you knew there was going to be some, and Alonzo Highsmith was going to go probably too. The Dorsey situation with a front office wide open has led to some pretty nice positions being open. And I think it was just a fact of life. And now we'll find out how good Gutekunst is in evaluating talent evaluators, because that's a big part of it too. Ted replaced some guys. Well, in some cases it was he just picked up on filled Ron's guys in there, like Gutekunst, like Elliott. But he's had to hire, Thompson has had to hire some guys to fill the lower positions, and they're working their way up. John Eric Sullivan's and John Wojciechowski's, they have to, Gutekunst has to evaluate them and decide whether to move them up or bring in someone that he knows. There's going to be, have to be some, filling of voids in that department, and we'll find out how good Gutekunst is at that, because that's a big part of his job as well.
Yeah, and one name that was thrown out there on Twitter that I had kind of forgot about a little bit, to be honest, is was it earlier this year or late last year that they allowed Tim Terry to leave and join Dorsey in Kansas City, and then Dorsey obviously leaves, and so now it was posited on Twitter, would Tim Terry potentially come back in what would likely amount to an elevated role here in Green Bay? So there's all kinds of factors involved, and I thought your point about him being able to evaluate talent evaluators is one that a lot of people forget, and I hadn't even thought about it really myself. That is a huge part of it, because Gutekunst can be the best evaluator of talent in the history of football, but if the guys in his office are not up to snuff, then you're not going to put together the best roster, because one guy can't possibly scout every player at every position and have any sort of a really good feel for, you know, what amounts to thousands of players across the league and the pro side, and then also in the draft as well.
Well, you know, Ron Wolf always wanted guys who would challenge him. He wanted to be challenged. Ron Wolf was going to do what he wanted to do, but and trust his evaluation. But he wanted guys to challenge his evaluation, to make a point on a guy and make him think about him in a different way. And I think that's what you're looking for, is someone who has the boldness and acumen to not only identify things about a player, but argue it too, and bring it to Wolf and explain why you should do it. And I think that's what Gutekunst needs, is that's why you need a big staff that can bring that kind of stuff to you.
So do you see, you know, I really don't know much about John Eric Sullivan or John Wojciechowski, and I'm not sure if you do either, so I could be putting you on the spot here for no reason, but do you see any of either of those guys sort of stepping up significantly from what you've heard or what you know about those two?
Well, they were put in those positions for a reason. You know, they were put in college scouting for Sullivan, and Wojciechowski was put in pro personnel for a reason. So I doubt they were put in those positions just because they couldn't find anybody else. So I would think it's logical that they would move up. But I think Gutekunst will be on the lookout for an assistant GM. I think that's going to be – I think Elliot Wolf would have been his assistant GM. And he may be on the lookout for someone like that, you know, or an executive VP of player personnel. I would not be surprised if he goes outside for that position, but I don't know if it'd be Tim Terry. I don't know what his opinion of Tim Terry is. You know, there's been other guys who've come through. I really don't know. So that'll be a key hire for him.
And then, of course, last week there was the formal introduction of Brian Gutekunst at a press conference at Lambeau Field, and then we had the opportunity to speak with him, ask some questions and things like that. And of course, the biggest thing that jumped out to me was how forceful he was in terms of outlining his philosophies of player acquisition. And I wrote this in a story that I thought the way Gutekunst carried himself in the press conference and in, you know, the subsequent questions afterward was perfect, in that he is a very even-keeled guy, as you mentioned. He has a very mild demeanor. He's not aggressive in terms of the way he converses with people or the way he answers questions. And in doing that, he was able to answer questions about Ted Thompson in a respectful and a deferential way that genuinely reflected, I think, the way he feels about Ted. But it also softened some of the things that he said that were actually very large departures from Thompson's philosophy, if you read just the words and don't consider the tone of voice. And so the two things that he really mentioned were, one, the idea that the Packers need to churn the bottom of the roster and create competition, because you can't have guys that are 50, 51, 52, 53 on your roster that don't feel any pressure. Those guys have to fight for their jobs every day, especially late in the season when there's injuries. And also the idea that they're going to be in on every possible acquisition they can. He said, we might not go all the way and sign the guy in free agency, but we want to at least be aware and have our hats essentially thrown in the ring to discuss those things. So what did you make of that outlined philosophy of personnel and how it could influence the roster in 2018?
Well, that's basically Ron Wolf's model, how he did it. And Ron Wolf, when I covered the team Tuesday, in the first 3-4 years that he was the GM, and it happened less when they had more of an established roster, but Tuesday was player acquisition day. Every single Tuesday, they'd bring in a half dozen guys, work them out, and sign somebody and replace someone on the roster. I mean, it happened almost every single Tuesday. And that was Wolf's philosophy of let's keep pushing. Let's keep trying to find somebody who's better than you know, the bottom six guys we have on our roster. And maybe one of those guys pushes himself higher. And, you know, when they won the Super Bowl, they had some guys, you know, contributing in that role. I think that's a healthy way to do it. You know, it's not the coaches. The coaches aren't necessarily in favor of that because it means they have to train guys. They have to teach guys. But that's what their job is. And, you know, it's you probably get kind of lazy. And when you don't ever have new guys coming in and you don't have to train them. So I think this is going to keep his staff on its toes. And they're going to have to, you know, they're going to bring guys in. This is like Belichick does. He brings guys in and they're expected to play by week one or week two. And I think, you know, McCarthy's going to have to do the same thing because Gutekunst is going to, at least if he's good to his word, he's going to roll that roster at the end. And I think that's healthy.
I agree with you completely. And I know that I can't remember if it was week 16 or 17, but there was one time that you and I were sitting in our office at Lambeau and we just sort of went through the number of guys on this roster that either only contribute on special teams or don't contribute hardly at all. And yeah. So I went through it again for a story I wrote on Gutekunst, and I've got the list in front of me. These are guys that ended the regular season on the 53-man roster that essentially, up until they were eliminated from the playoffs, either only played on special teams or gave the Packers absolutely nothing at all. And the list is extremely long. You have Lindsey Pipkins, Donatello Brown, Marwin Evans, Dylan Day, Ulrich John, Adam Pankey, Devontae Mays, Joe Carriage, Chris Odom. That's 17% of your 53-man roster that either gives you a little bit on special teams or gives you nothing at all. And I'd have to go and compare it to the rest of the league, but that seems crazy to me.
Well, and can't and isn't pushing to get on the 45-man roster. They're never getting on the 45-man roster.
Right.
46, I'm sorry. It's crazy. It's like you're just stocking these guys for next year, and they're all undrafted free agents. It's not like, I mean, you know, or late round picks. So, yeah, to me, that's like a wasteland. You know, if you think that, okay, I can see that with a defensive line or offensive lineman.
Sure.
You know, you get a guy and you like him, but he's just not strong enough. And I mean, he's got really good feet. Yeah, you stash him for the whole year, but you don't stash seven or eight guys.
Exactly.
You know, you stash one or two. And that, I think, was the problem.
And not only that, you know, you mentioned competing for the 45-man roster. It's also just the fact that you're essentially telling Mike McCarthy that he has to go out and try and win games with what amounts to about a 43-man roster.
Yeah.
And you know, basically there's no competition to get on the 46, like you said. And in addition to that, there's not a lot of competition in terms of guys fighting to get off the 46 onto to get off the 7 inactive list and get onto the 46. And I just think it puts such a disadvantage to teams. Like, I know the comparison is always New England, but there's a reason it's always New England, and it's because they do things in a way that seems to take advantage of every spot they have. And you know, I mean, how often does Belichick cut guys and pick up veterans and try a guy? Like, I mean, you know, they're bringing in, who was it that they brought in, like, maybe 6-7 years ago, Corey Dillon, the running back that had been cast off in Cincinnati and came in and gave them like one 1,600-yard season. I mean, they've tried.
Well, they've done that this year. They brought in, you know, Martellus Bennett after the Packers cut him, Ricky Jean-Francois, you know.
Kenny Britt, Michael Floyd.
Yeah, Kenny Britt, exactly. You know, they try him. Now, Belichick didn't invent this, you know. I mean, Ron Wolf was doing this a long time before Bill Belichick was ever in the league.
Yep.
So that's what's really, I don't know if the word is, what the word is, but it's really what's kind of a slap in the face to that philosophy, because Thompson grew up in that philosophy, saw what it did for the Packers, and he just kind of abandoned it. And it was there. They were the innovators of that. And all of a sudden they got away from it.
So yeah, I really agree with you. You know, I think that this was certainly, you know, a method that Thompson was familiar with and one that he could have been taking advantage of all along. And that was probably one of the things that fans and maybe even some of his subordinates were frustrated with. But I think that's a pretty good look at what's gone on in the front office. We still have a lot to discuss in terms of defensive coordinator and coaching staff. And I think we're probably going to pause here, and we'll give you another episode that talks about the new defensive coordinator, Mike Pettine, and any of the changes on that side of the ball. We'll talk about that in an episode that comes out first thing Monday morning. So before we wrap up here, Tom, we got to do some playoff picks.
Oh my God. Yeah. I forgot the playoffs were even going on.
I know, it's weird, isn't it?
Seriously. I'm like, oh yeah, I got to make my picks tomorrow too.
So let's take a look at the odds here. I'll pull up the odds really quickly. All right. We've got Atlanta -3 on the road at Philadelphia. Who do you like in that one?
I think I like Atlanta. I think they're kind of hot. I think they're going to go in there and beat Philadelphia. I'll always take a team with a better quarterback, and I think that Atlanta has the better quarterback. Philadelphia's defense is really good, but I don't trust their quarterback, so I'm going to go with Atlanta.
All right, you and I agree on that one. Now, how about New England -13.5 at home against Tennessee?
Yeah, I mean, as much as I want to pick Tennessee, it's not going to happen, and I don't think it'll even be close.
I don't either. I think they're going to roll over them pretty easily. Now, one that I still think Pittsburgh is going to win this game, but Pittsburgh at home -7 against Jacksonville. Boy, that Jacksonville defense looks good.
Heck yeah, that is going to be a dogfight. And, you know, the down part of this for Pittsburgh, if they win, is that they are going to just be, you know, that this is a much tougher fight for them than New England's getting with Tennessee. So I will take Pittsburgh, but man, I want to see how much of a toll that is, because I picked Pittsburgh to go to the Super Bowl and I still believe in that, but you know, that Jacksonville team is really an up and comer.
And not only that, but they're playing Sunday, so New England has an extra day of rest as well built into that.
Right.
So that's something to consider too. And then the last game, the one that Packers fans probably have the most interest in, would be Minnesota -4.5 or 5, depending on the casino, at home against New Orleans. I think that has the potential to be the best game of the weekend.
Yeah, it really could. You know, the interesting part about that game is it could be a defensive game. We know Minnesota's a defensive team, so that's logical. But, you know, New Orleans has been relying a lot more on its defense. And that could be really a low-scoring game. And I don't know. If it is, I kind of like New Orleans, because I think ultimately you want the quarterback, if it's close, you want the quarterback to have the ball in his hands in the fourth quarter with a chance to win. And I'll take Drew Brees over Case Keenum 9 days out of 10. So I don't know. I kind of think about that some more, but since I have to make a pick, I'm going to go with New Orleans.
Yeah, you know, I am too. I think it's for exactly the reason that you just said. If this is a low-scoring game and all of a sudden Case Keenum needs to put together a winning drive in the final 3.5 minutes, I'm not sold. And, you know, for as absolutely disastrous as the New Orleans defense was in those first two games, I don't think anybody's made more significant improvements since then, because they were giving up 45 and 50 points the first 2 weeks of the season. And now they're playing really darn good football. And boy, I mean, this is totally on an unrelated note, but how good is the draft class that New Orleans had this year? Holy cow.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah, just how do you get the offensive and defensive player of the year in one draft? Not to mention a starting safety. You know, I mean, that's just crazy. And good free agency, too.
And a future Hall of Fame quarterback in Taysom Hill, right?
Yeah. That's right. Special teams player of the year.
So there you have it. Those are the four games this weekend. We thank you guys for bearing with us in our little bit of a respite here between episodes of the podcast. But we gave you about 45 minutes to chew on today, and there will be another episode first thing Monday morning that will catch you up on everything related to the defensive coaching changes, as well as some movement on the offensive side of the ball. So again, thank you all very much for listening, and we will talk to you guys soon.
To grow up.